From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review The High Note, a romantic drama starring Dakota Johnson and Tracy Ellis Ross. Also, the sci-fi mystery from first-time director Andrew Patterson, The Vast of Night. And we'll hear about the docudrama, The Infiltrators. Also on tap this week, the re-release of The Gray Fox, a 1982 Western starring Richard Farnsworth, which has been restored in a 4K version, now available for streaming. And we'll talk about the French-Algerian drama, Pepicha, as well. Those and more films coming up on Film Week on KPCC.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us for this weekend's review of a whole slew of streaming and on-demand films. Joining me this week, Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom. Peter Rayner, film critic for the Christian Science Monitor and the president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, Claudia Puig. First up this week is the romantic drama The High Note. It stars Dakota Johnson, Tracy Ellis Ross, and Ice Cube. Nisha Ganatra is the director and Flora Greeson the screenwriter. Amy, what do you think of The High Note?
Oh, this movie is so fun. The story here is that Dakota Johnson, who I just think is the best at playing hapless heroines, the kind who are tripping over their shoes, but you actually can buy it when it's Dakota Johnson. She plays a young woman who wants to be a music producer. She has a great ear. She's working as an assistant to this woman named Grace Davis, who's played by Tracy Ellis Ross, who's like this incredible powerhouse, like late 80s, early 90s. I mean, think like Madonna, Mariah, Whitney. She's like up there in terms of power and clout. And she's her personal assistant. So it's a movie that, you know, has a touch of that like, oh, thankless, running around, fetching her green juices, kind of like peon relationship. But it has so much intelligence. I just think the characters played by both of these women are fantastic. And this is one of those movies where you actually see music getting made, where it's not just like, dun, 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 and here's a cool song. Like when Dakota Johnson meets this young musician played by Kelvin Harrison Jr., who's also amazing, you watch them just create together. And it feels like a movie with so much love of music in its soul. I had the best time watching this.
We're talking about The High Note, which is available on just about every on-demand platform imaginable. Claudia, what'd you think?
Well, I echo everything that Amy said. I feel like this is an enchanting and escapist summer movie. It's, you know, we can use some escape right about now. And it also, it has something to say about the male-driven world of pop music, which we're going to discuss with a much more sordid cast when we discuss On the Record. But it's it says something about women with ambition and you know what it's like to be in the pop music world and to be a woman. But it's also light and entertaining, and it's got a bit of a fairy tale quality to it in the best way. It reminds me a little bit of a movie that I think Amy and I both had liked this movie a few years back called Beyond the Lights, which directed by Gina Prince Bythewood. And I really like the script. This particular script is it's by Flora Greeson. It was on the 2018 Blacklist, and it's directed by Nisha Ganatra, who explored kind of similar territory last year with Late Night about being a woman in a man's world. But I think she did it better this time around. I feel like this is maybe because the casting is better and the music is really fun. And not only is there a great chemistry between Tracy Ellis Ross and Dakota Johnson, but Kelvin Harrison Jr., who's rapidly becoming one of my favorite young actors, who was so fantastic in Waves and Loose last year, he can really sing. This movie fires on all cylinders. I loved it.
That's great. And you should just mention for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, what is that blacklist that Flora Greeson was on?
Oh, those are films that are scripts that were never made, but have gone through, or you know, have people pull them out of the blacklist, you know, this particular screenwriter was like I think she was a CAA assistant. She's a first-time screenwriter, and she's developed these characters so well. So, you know, you really have a sense of them, and I so agree about Dakota Johnson. I feel like she's just is really good at listening and playing against people. There's a scene where she's with, I'm blanking out on his name.
Not Eddie Izzard?
Yes.
Okay. I was just a stab in the dark.
Yeah, no, good stab, because he's a tough one to go up against. I mean, playing against Eddie Izzard, it can't be easy, and she does it so well and so naturally. I just feel like she's, and Tracy Ellis Ross, her comic timing is perfect.
The High Note is rated PG-13. It's available on just about every on-demand platform you can find. The Vast of Night has a wonderful premise because a radio DJ is involved in an investigation along with a switchboard operator. The film's directed by Andrew Patterson in his directing debut. James Montague and Craig W. Sanger wrote the screenplay. The movie stars Sierra McCormick and Jake Horowitz. Peter, what'd you think of The Vast of Night?
It's a terrific little movie. It's set in the 1950s small town New Mexico. And these two high schoolers, switchboard operator played by Sierra McCormick and the radio DJ, Jake Horowitz, something's up in this town. They hear this kind of strange audio frequency coming across the airwaves, and they drop calls, and mysterious people call in to the switchboard, and all sorts of things go on. So you would think that with all of the cliches that are ever present with, you know, UFO movies and the desert, and that this movie would just sort of be generic, but it's remarkably sharp and funny and ominous, and it's a terrific debut. I mean, the director, Andrew Patterson, really is in full control of what looks to be a budget of about $28. You know, the two lead actors are marvelous, and it really it's framed as a kind of Twilight Zone episode, which is also kind of interesting in a meta sort of way. It opens, you know, as if we were watching a Twilight Zone type show that's called Paradox Theater, and then it moves into the story itself. But what I found interesting about this film is that it's such, in addition to everything else, it has such a fascinating mixture of tones, you know, sort of scary, funny, ominous, weird, goofy. All of these things sort of mesh, in ways that seem very organic. And I think it was a slam dance picture, if I'm not mistaken. And it's just really a terrific debut. I hope this director doesn't go on to do big Marvel movies right away.
Well, you're going to get to hear from the director, Andrew Patterson, because our John Horn talked with him about directing his first feature film. And he, in fact, talks about that framing device that you just mentioned. He comments on that. You'll hear the conversation later this hour. John Horn with director Andrew Patterson on Film Week. Amy, what did you think of The Vast of Night?
Yeah, I'm also really knocked out by this film. And Peter's right, it went to Slam Dance, and then it climbed its way through film festivals this year. It just won so many prizes and kept getting bigger and bigger notice. And I have to admit up at the top, I'm a tiny bit biased. I don't know Andrew Patterson at all, but he's from Oklahoma, and I went to college in Oklahoma. And there was a time when if you wanted to be a filmmaker, you had to leave Oklahoma. And he managed to stay there, gather his group of friends, shoot this in a neighboring state on an Oklahoma budget. And it really has that feel of a young filmmaker with so much ambition. It's like watching Evil Dead or Clerks, you know, where you see somebody with confidence behind the camera, because he does a lot of things that, despite the low budget, they're there to get your attention. There's a scene where he holds the camera just on Sierra McCormick for it feels like 8 or 9 minutes as she works the switchblade as a switchboard operator, just static, letting her perform, us being aware of his confidence in his material, his confidence in his actors. There's a tracking shot in here that's just unbelievable. I think they did it with go-karts, you know, in a tiny rural town. I mean, I'm thrilled that this guy exists, and I cannot wait to see what he does next.
The Vast of Night, Claudia.
I agree. I'm really looking forward to what he does next. In addition to, you know, the reference to Twilight Zone, which is obviously a really major reference with his sort of knockoff show, The Paradox Theater, I also got a little bit of sort of a homage or reference to like American Graffiti, you know, with the 50s small town feel. And yet there's this great sense of unease. And I think some of that comes from those long takes and the tracking shot. It's very involving. At first, you kind of don't know what's going on, and then you quickly become more and more involved. It's very low key, obviously extremely low budget, but very stylish and very clever.
The Vast of Night, science fiction mystery film, is available on Amazon Prime Video. It's rated PG-13. The drama The Infiltrators stars Maynard Alvarado and Chelsea Rendon. The film is directed by Christina Ibarra and Alex Rivera. Rivera and Aldo Velasco wrote the screenplay. Claudia.
I love this documentary. I saw it at Sundance, and I think it was compelling and timely then. It continues to be. It's a docu-thriller, so it's a documentary, but it also has some reenacted scenes. It's based on a true story of young immigrants, dreamers, who are members of this, it's called the National Immigrant Youth Alliance, and they're on a mission to stop unjust deportations. And they get themselves locked into a for-profit detention center in Florida intentionally. So it's like instead of breaking out, you're breaking in. And they're doing this in order to help the people who are detained there and to get them, hopefully the proper legal help that they need. So it weaves the footage of the real infiltrators with reenactments. And it's a thrilling, you're on the edge of your seat. It kind of blends these genres. The filmmakers, Alex Rivera and Christina Ibarra, who are a married couple, have this great sort of ability to, you know, bring all of this to vivid emotional life. They're not fictionalizing fact, but they're bringing, important facts to life, and it's absorbing, it's timely. I thought it was really great.
The Infiltrators, Amy.
Yeah, I think it's so smart how the directors made this film exist. You know, it's documentary right up until the minute that these kids go inside. And then from then on, it's very clear this is an actor reenacting what happens. But often they have some original audio footage that they manage to record that they are able to kind of weave in and out as the actors are now taking over. And, you know, what really strikes you here is just how bright and media savvy these young dreamers are. You know, they wear their high school graduation cap and gown for sit-ins. They are so bright in the way they've put all of this together, the way they communicate. And, you know, there's scenes in here that I love that, are wrenching. Like, there's a scene where they talk about, like, one girl is trying to get arrested, and so she's aware that she's almost having to put on a fake identity and play into stereotypes of what they think an undocumented woman looks like to show up at the Border Patrol in the first place, and wrestling with that. And you just see that these kids have so much potential to really be great leaders in this country, and many of them can't even go to college. So they're using their energy here, directing it in this way, and it's really spectacular that they're doing that. And also, you can't help but notice, you know, this action in this film that's so tense and so dark already is happening in 2012. And so you know that it's going to get even worse. And that kind of umbrella casts a shadow over this whole movie as well.
The Infiltrators, Peter.
Yeah, it's a powerful movie. I found it a little unwieldy in the going back and forth between, the reenactments and the actual people. But I think its great achievement is that it puts a human face on these immigrants and detainees who we often read about in headlines, but we don't really see the innards of the situation. And it's worth pointing out, you know, as Amy said, this film takes place almost entirely in 2012, which was the Obama era, when 3 million people were deported, you know, half of them with no criminal records. The film doesn't have a political edge per se. That information is not in the movie. But I think it's worth mentioning.
All right. The film is The Infiltrators. It's unrated and available on the Fandango Now on-demand platform. Also this week, the documentary On the Record, which is part of the launch of the new streaming site HBO Max, the film directed by Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering. Claudia?
I thought this was a really fascinating documentary. It also played at Sundance, and there's also some controversy surrounding it because Oprah Winfrey was originally involved, and then she withdrew as executive producer, presumably under some pressure from Russell Simmons, who is the person who is being accused by 20 different women of sexual assault and rape. And this is so compelling. It's intimate because, you get the stories of the women. But I think what makes it really particularly interesting is it shines a light into an aspect of the Me Too movement that we haven't really seen, at least I haven't seen in a documentary yet, which is about women of color, particularly black women, how much, how complicated it is when they accuse a black man of sexual assault. It talks about how disconnected they felt from the Me Too movement. And it's just about, the idea that they don't want to pile on to the already, the view of men as black men as sexually aggressive.
Hold that thought, please. We'll come back to you. We're talking about the documentary on the new streaming service, HBO Max, On the Record. We'll be back with more with our trio of
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Critics in 1 minute. So good to have you with us today on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Claudia Puig, Peter Rayner, and Amy Nicholson. Claudia was just telling us about the HBO Max documentary On the Record, directed by Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering. It takes a look at accusations of sexual assault against music producer Russell Simmons, a recording mogul. And Claudia, you were just saying it gets into some nuanced and difficult issues about how race plays into these allegations.
Exactly. Yes, the fear of being disloyal to your race. The women discuss that. They're, ever mindful of how the legal system has been so brutal to black men. And, of course, we're experiencing this right now with George Floyd. And so essentially one of the Drew Dixon, who's one of the lead accusers, says, I took it for the team. I didn't want to let my culture down. And she says, your responsibility to muffle your screams is greater than his responsibility not to do it in the first place. So, there's that extra layer of not wanting to be judged as a traitor to your race, and how, she wanted Russell Simmons to be the hero that other people saw him as. And so it adds this fascinating complexity to, this very thorny and difficult issue. And I feel like the filmmakers, Kirby Dick, of course, is a veteran filmmaker. He's worked with Amy Ziering before. I feel like this is really compelling. It's intimate. It's really well shot. And it goes into, territory that hasn't been covered before.
We're talking about the documentary On the Record. Amy, what were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, exactly. As Claudia was saying, Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering, they have really unimpeachable bona fides when it comes to making documentaries on this subject. They did the one about sexual assault in the military, The Invisible War. They did the one about sexual assault on college campuses, The Hunting Ground. And so, they come to this documentary with just so much behind them in terms of the way they know how to tell these stories, the way they know how to listen, the way they're able to really put these stories out there, and the way that that they are credible. And a lot of this documentary is also framed by the idea of credibility, because one of the things Drew Dixon does early on is she says she's going to talk to the New York Times. So you get almost this parallel modern day narrative of what it's like to be a person contacting the New York Times, have them look through your life. You know, the journalism and fact checking that goes into it also in real time in the modern era. And I also do really admire the different tangents this documentary goes down. You know, you do get this great look at the music industry in, you know, the late 90s and the early 80s, the early Biggie days. You get to see the intelligence that Drew Dixon had with her own career. Her ear was great. She helped create some great songs. And you see how her gender gets used against her as a weapon and how women do get marginalized. There's the attacks, and then there's also just the way she's pressured out of the industry, which are also really heartbreaking. And I appreciate that they even go into detail into just the misogyny in music in general, not just in like rap and hip hop, but in all music, you know, and that women have been trained through music to like laugh off things, to tolerate things, and to support what they can in the music, to support the artists and the politics they're saying, and, you know, shrug off the rest of it. So there's a lot here to chew on.
On the Record documentary is on HBO's new streaming service, HBO Max. It's unrated. A wonderful film, The Gray Fox, from 1982, starring Richard Farnsworth, has been restored, a 4K restoration of the film. Peter, share with us the joys of The Gray Fox.
This is a wonderful movie. It was the debut of a director, Phil Borsos, who was a protege of Francis Coppola's, who fortunately, you know, died young in his 40s. Made about four other features. Richard Farnsworth broke through as a lead actor in this film. He'd been doing supporting roles for a long time. He'd been a stuntman for many years. He was one of the chariot riders in in Spartacus. But in this movie, he plays a gentleman crook who is released after 33 years in prison for having been a stagecoach robber in 1901. He settles down with his sister for a while, but he can't stand the straight life. It reminded me a little bit of a film I know we both love, Larry, Straight Time.
Yeah.
You know, like, what do you do when you get out of prison and you can't adapt?
Dustin Hoffman starring film, yeah.
Yeah, so he watches the 1903 Great Train Robbery, a famous, you know, early silent film, and a light goes off in his head, Bill Miner, and says, gee, I can rob trains now. I don't have to rob stagecoaches. Which he does, and then he skedaddles to remote British Columbia and takes up with a trained unionist and photographer played by Jackie Burroughs. And it's remarkably, beautifully, lyrically shot. It's in some ways semi-documentary style, but also, you know, very lyrical, almost rapturous. And Farnsworth is absolutely extraordinary. He went on to, you know, be known for a lot of movies like The Baseball Coach in The Natural and Comes a Horseman. He was marvelous in the David Lynch movie Straight Story. But here he's playing someone who's, you know, really ornery, but somehow, you know, folkloric in ways that don't seem phony. And it's a marvelous. I guess if it were remade today, Sam Elliott would be in the role. Handlebar mustache. But it's such a marvelously lived-in performance, and an interesting historical side note. Apparently, the character it's based on, Bill Miner, originated the term "hands up."
Really?
Yes, I didn't know you could actually originate something like that. But he was the one who came out with that, and then I guess it got picked up by a lot of other criminals. So.
The Gray Fox, wonderful Canadian film from 1982, re-released in a remastered 4K version. It's a gorgeous film to begin with. Richard Farnsworth in a wonderful leading performance. Philip Borsos directing, John Hunter, the screenplay. It's rated PG, and you can see it in multiple virtual cinemas, including the Fridas and in Lemley's virtual cinema, The Gray Fox. Also out this week, a French-Algerian drama, Papicha. The film is written and directed by Mounia Madour. Amy?
This is another great film. We're having a good week, aren't we, this
yeah.
week? Papicha comes to us from Cannes. It played Un Certain Regard. And this film, I'm going to describe the plot, and it's going to make it sound way cuter than it actually is, but this movie is fantastic. The story here is you're in Algeria in the early 90s, and there's a group of girls who are going to college together, and they love breaking out of the dormitory and going to clubs and singing CNC Music Factory and selling dresses to the other women, you know, putting on lipstick and makeup and making these homemade dresses for other women to dress up in. And as they're, you know, excited about their future, wanting to be these fashion designers, you see, you know, the increasing conservatism in Algeria start to close around them and the movements towards making women cover themselves completely. And the lead girl here, the main fashion designer, her name is Lena, or she's played by Lena Kudry. She just has this intense charisma. It's kind of like devil may care. She's just going to do it anyways. And you really buy her as a rebellious person who cannot believe this is happening. And every single step of the way, you know, she spits on people. She yells back. She does not take any of this grief from people, and it doesn't really help. And so to watch this noose kind of close around her neck is really heartbreaking. And this film just has such an energy to it. There's bits of it that feel a little bit Lady Macbethian, but I had a ton of fun watching this. I think people really like it.
Lena Kudry stars in Papicha, the film written and directed by Munya Madur. It's unrated and available on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. And Then We Danced, a Swedish romantic drama, a film written and directed by Levon Akin. Peter.
This is a very interesting movie about a sort of subject that's rather remote for most people. It's the National Georgian Ensemble. It's a dance group in Georgia. This is not America's southern Georgia, Russia. And the young dancer Mirab, who's played very well by an actor named Levon Gelbakian, is challenged in trying out for this new a dance company with a new a dancer named Irakli. Baki Valishvili is the name of the actor. And he feels threatened by this guy because he's a better dancer, and he's also attracted to him. And Mirab has a woman who's a partner with him in the dance. But the thing is that in the Georgian dance tradition, for men, you have to be very, you know, stereotypically masculine, and you can't, you know, show any, you know, emotion. You know, everything has to be very staunch and upright and solid. And Mirab dances not like that at all, and so he's ostracized by the group. It's a little bit sort of like a cross between The Turning Point and Call Me by Your Name. but it's there's a lot of good dance footage in it as well, which is, you know, a lot of dance movies, they fool around with a lot of fancy cutting and inserts and close-ups, but here you get to see, you know, the whole bodies, and it's, you know, that's, I appreciated that as well.
And Then We Danced, the film that's set in Georgia, the film written and directed by Levon Akin. It's unrated, and it's on multiple on-demand platforms. I'm No Longer Here, a Mexican drama starring Juan Daniel Garcia and Angelina Chen. It's written and directed by Fernando Frias de la Parra. Claudia, what'd you think of I'm No Longer Here?
Well, we are having a good week. So far, everything's been really good.
Yeah.
So I really liked this film. It is beautifully shot. It's gorgeously composed and framed. It's a story of identity, alienation, also initiation, and also immigration, since we were talking about that as well a minute ago, and how isolated you can feel as a teenager if you're living in a strange land. But it's also this really intriguing and vivid portrait of a subculture in Monterrey, Mexico, that feels like this kind of hip ethnography in a really interesting way. It's a film that kind of is fascinating and sort of hypnotically washes over you, and I think that has a lot to do with the cinematography, the music, and then this lead performance by Juan Daniel Garcia, who is not a trained actor, and he is, it's this subculture, he's a part of this gang, and they're, they love cumbia music, which is from Colombia. They call themselves Colombianos. There's also a little bit of, like, cholo culture there. And he's this very cool guy in his world in this kind of town in Monterrey. And then because of some things that happen that involve sort of a rival gang. He ends up having to go to Queens, to this very diverse community in Queens, but he's pretty lost there. And he's got this very distinctive look. His hair that will, you know, you'll be riveted just kind of looking at his hair, and it becomes kind of a character of its own in the film. It's just this vibrant slice of life that I found really compelling, and I think this filmmaker, Fernando Frias de la Parra, is also really an interesting person to watch. He is responsible for Los Spookies on HBO, which is, it shows that he can do horror and comedy, and now this kind of drama mixed with music. I just think he's definitely a filmmaker to watch.
I'm No Longer Here. What do you think, Amy?
Yeah, I really did love the times when you just watch this film, observe these guys. You know, the music that they listen to, it's cumbia that's slowed way down. They say they slow it way down so that they can conserve the batteries on their iPods and Walkman. But it makes all the music sound like Tom Waits. You know, I didn't know it was slowed down at the beginning. I was like, who is this? I want this album. This album is incredible. And when it just observes things like the way they do their sideburns, the way they tie their shoes, the way they wear baggy clothes, all of that, you buy, you know, how special he is to this clique that he's in, that he's like the centerpiece. And, you know, I don't know if anybody knows that feeling of like you were cool in one school, you had to transfer schools, and suddenly you're a nerd. This is like that, but just amplified to the 80th degree, that all of these things that he considered to be special and sacred, nobody in Queens understands or cares about, except for, and the one quibble I have with this film is there's like this kind of tentative sort of friendship romance with a girl in Queens who I just think is a really terrible flat character that kind of kills a little bit of the New York scenes for me. But when this film is in Mexico, it's really special.
The movie is I'm No Longer Here, starring Juan Daniel Garcia. Fernando Frias de la Parra wrote and directed it. The unrated movie is streaming on Netflix. I Will Make You Mine, a drama that stars Lin Chen and Ye Ming Chen. It's written and directed by Lin Chen. Claudia?
I like this movie. If you're a fan of the Before trilogy, I think this could appeal to you, although it's not on the same level as Richard Linklater's films. But Lin Chen sort of took over. I'm not familiar with the two previous films in this trilogy, which are Surrogate Valentine and Daylight Savings. These are very, very low-budget little indies. But I don't think you need to have, you know, seen the first one to appreciate this one. It's a slight film. It's not like, you know, you're going to go around going, this is the greatest movie ever. But there's a nice little kind of attention to character detail. There's some gentle humor. There's some nice music. It's the music of Go Nakamura, who is a singer-songwriter. It's kind of folky, alternative, acoustic. And it's set in L.A., so that makes it also appealing. It's very naturalistic, and it just feels sensitive and detailed, and it's about relationships and regret.
All right, and when we come back, we'll hear what Peter thought of I Will Make You Mine, written and directed by Lin Chen, who also stars in the film. It's rated R. We also have other picks that our critics are going to be sharing with us, so stay tuned. Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. We'll be back in just a minute. So good to have you with us today for Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Peter Rayner, Amy Nicholson, and Claudia Puig. We're talking about I Will Make You Mine, written and directed by Lin Chen, who also stars in the L.A. set film. Peter, you have a quick thought on the film?
Yeah, I think it's an agreeable movie. I didn't, you know, lose my socks over it, but it does have some good feeling for, you know, these women and the various connections they have to Go Nakamura. It's just that Go Nakamura, at least in this film, like Claudia, I've not seen the first two, so I may be at a loss on the trilogy aspect of it. But, you know, he seems like not a guy that you would exactly have everyone going nuts over in one way or another, which is not to slight him. It's just, you know, that's sort of who he is, and it doesn't quite add up in terms of the drama of the film. But one of the actresses, Ye Ming Chen, I think, was a standout for me as a performer.
I Will Make You Mine is rated R, and it's streaming on multiple on-demand platforms. Well, let's turn our attention to some of our critics' favorite films. Aren't necessarily new this week, but definitely deserving of attention. Claudia, you've picked one of my favorites, a John Sayles film, beautiful scenery, a wonderful mythological story, The Secret of Roan Inish. Why do you love that film so much?
Oh, I remember when I first saw it, and I was just transported. It's so beautiful. It's this, you know, very optimistic, low-key fairy tale, so steeped in Irish folklore. I think that movie was something that has, I saw, you know, 1995 when it came out. It's always made me want to go to Ireland, and I've since gone to Ireland a couple times, but I think it probably started my fascination with it in a way, and the Selkies and all that, the lore. I just think it's a beautiful setting. The cinematography by Haskell Wexler is so stunning. It's such great family fare.
And the music as well. The music's great.
Music. Oh, my gosh. Yes. Yeah.
So that's streaming on Amazon Prime, as is the series Forever, starring Maya Rudolph and Fred Armisen. I haven't seen it. Claudia, tell us about it.
Well, Maya Rudolph is sensational in this, and Fred Armisen is very good, too. It's created by Alan Yang, who did a Netflix movie that we talked about on Film Week a few weeks ago called Tiger Tail. It's a kind of a series that you can binge in sort of one night. They're a suburban married couple. They live in, I think it's Riverside or San Bernardino, one of those two places, leading this very mundane, super routine life, until something happens where they no longer do. And it's got this wry humor to it. It's kind of wistful. And it's also kind of a look at relationships and, you know, the whole dynamic of comfort in a relationship versus, you know, change and risk. And it's just very clever. I wish it had gone on. It was, I think, just one season.
Forever is the series on Amazon Prime. Let's go to you, Amy, for some suggestions. Online Film Fest, We Are One, streaming on YouTube for 10 days, starting on May 29th. Share with us about how these festivals are going to be showing some of their films.
Yeah, it's been really fascinating watching film festivals figure this out. You know, last week we had Chattanooga, which was really cool. And this week is something I think even on a bigger scale, the We Are One Festival. It has 21 participating festivals like Berlin, Cannes, Venice, Sundance, Toronto, New York, Locarno, places you dream of going, Marrakesh, Jerusalem, Mumbai, Sarajevo. It's everywhere. And it's free, although taking donations. And what is happening is that each of these 21 festivals has offered up picks either from this year or classic picks that they premiered a few years ago to be screened on the We Are One Online Film Festival YouTube channel. And it's going to be rolled out a bit like a film festival. Things have premiere dates, you know, so you can kind of monitor and like watch right when it comes on. And then I believe once they premiere, they'll continue to screen for the next week. So this goes on for 10 days. And I mean, it's amazing. I pulled out a couple of things I thought people might be really interested in and checking out in particular. You know, last year we talked so much about that film Atlantics by Maddie Diop.
Yes.
At LAFCO. We gave her the Best Cinematography Prize. And one of the things they're going to put online is her original short from 2009 called Atlantiques with a Q, which is like the prototype for how she built her way up into making this film. There's some old restored black and white classics that I am really dying to check out. One of them is called The Epic of Everest, which is from the 1924 expedition to Everest. And it was the third attempt for a few of the climbers, and two people died making it. And it's just this hand-cranked, astonishing documentary from 1924 that it just sounds breathtaking. They're also going to be showing this 1928 silent epic from India called Shiraz, which was shot on location at the Taj Mahal. And it is just bigger than bigger. I mean, it's like D.W. Griffith dreams of making a film like this. The local Maharajas loaned jewelry and clothing and elephants to the production. And it's been updated with a score by Anusha Shankar, who is Ravi Shankar's daughter. And for something absolutely on the complete other end of this. I mean, this is one of the things I'm really dying to see at the festival because I missed it at TIFF. TIFF brought a film to this called Crazy World. Have you guys heard about Wakollywood?
No.
Okay, Wakollywood is like this Ugandan crazy action cinema from this neighborhood called Wakaliga. And they just do these insane action movies. I mean, this is one about like mobsters and these kids who get kidnapped, but the kids know kung fu. But the thing about Ugandan storytelling is that they have not just the film, they have a hype man who spends the whole film commenting on the film that they called Video Joker, who just yells. And at TIFF, they had a person come in person, and I missed it because I had to fly home. But here, they've recorded the voice of a Video Joker. So if you watch Crazy World, he's just going to be also yelling on top of the movie.
Which so this, sounds- like, if you like going to movies and having people talk back and yell at the screen and all, which can be quite entertaining for some movies, this is kind of like that, it sounds like.
Exactly. He like comments on it. It's this whole other layer. And they say it does come from like traditional forms of Ugandan storytelling. So there's all sorts of features. I would check out the entire schedule. There's also conversations that they're rebroadcasting for a bunch of festivals this year. Like Jane Campion had a conversation with Tessa Thompson at Sundance. Ang Lee and Hirokazu Koreeda had a conversation in Berlin. There's one with John Waters. There's one with Francis Ford Coppola and Steven Soderbergh. There's just so much.
That sounds great. All right. Amy telling us about online film festival We Are One, which is streaming on YouTube, all these different picks from film festivals. We have just about 2 minutes left, Peter, for a couple of films for you to highlight. Let's talk about, The Lunchbox from Irfan Khan from 2013. Just a wonderful movie set in Mumbai.
Yeah, it's a terrific film. It was... Irfan Khan's one of his very best movies. He died a month ago, unfortunately. Wonderful actor. It was from India, a lonely housewife. Delicious daily lunchboxes are mistakenly delivered not to her husband every day, but to a widower played by the Khan, and then they exchange ardent letters, sharing stories of their lives. It's a really sweet movie, and it was a success when it came out, and I hope it can, get a second life.
So good. 2013 on multiple platforms. Also, the wonderful Japanese film Tampopo from 1985.
Yeah, this was billed when it came out as a ramen Western. The film is completely uncharacterizable. Juzi Otami directed it, and it's about the search for a sort of surly trucker teams up with a widowed noodle shop owner, and together they search for the perfect ramen. A spoiler alert, the search is successful.
It's a wild, funny film, Tampopo from 1985. These are all food-themed films. Peter wants to remind us are out there on streaming services, including 1996's Big Night with Tony Shalhoub and Stanley Tucci, Babette's Feast from 1987, Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, I Can Never Think of the Expression, Just One Little Mint, in the same way again after that film. It's Film Week on KPCC.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Larry Mantle. Earlier today, our critics were praising the science fiction mystery The Vast of Night. It's available to stream on Amazon Prime. It's the directorial debut for Andrew Patterson. He made the film with a tiny budget and no formal film school education. But the end result has critics and others lauding the film as an achievement a veteran director would be proud of. KPCC's John Horn sat down with the director, Patterson, this week, and he asked him where he learned to make movies.
The short answer is I was able to work in short form with cameras. And I mean, you know, you get to where you put enough people on camera for anything, short documentaries, promotional pieces, and so on. And if you're doing that all the same time you're watching, you know, 200 or 300 movies a year, those two things, I think, kind of take care of themselves. You have a craft that you're actually working very hard on, sometimes making 50 to 100 individual pieces of short form media a year. And then at the same time, every single day, you're kind of settling down with great filmmakers and just getting to watch what they do.
One of the things that is remarkable about your film from where I sit is your hero, or one of your heroes, Everett, is a radio host. We don't see a lot of radio hosts with centerpiece roles in movies. How did you decide about the jobs that your lead characters, Everett and Faye, have? One's a radio host, one works a switchboard. What do those occupations serve in terms of their ability to tell this story through heard conversations?
Early on in our research for the script, we stumbled across kind of what we learned was a very, especially in UFO communities, a very infamous incident from Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, called the Kecksburg Incident, where a radio DJ starts getting calls from people all over Pennsylvania, rural Pennsylvania, that something had fallen out of the sky and had crashed into some, you know, trees and broken some branches. And then people went out and looked at it, and it was this large, you know, acorn-shaped thing about the size of a Volkswagen Bug. And it's highly documented. And a lot of it was documented by this jock, this late 50s, early 60s DJ. And man, that was a key to open up a really unique angle on a movie that I hadn't seen yet, where you kind of got locked into a place with a guy that had access to these phone calls, but couldn't necessarily just run off and decide to leave the station. And then the other occupation is a switchboard operator, which is, that makes her sort of, you know, in her role, when you sit down at the switchboard and you're the only one working, you're the one that connects everybody. And you're the one that has all the control over any call being made. And it also puts her in a position where she could start to do research right there from her very much locked in position, and she could start making calls to figure out what was going on when a new sound comes through the radio and the switchboard. She can start making calls right there. And that was an exciting, dramatic place to be able to position a movie from.
One of the things that you do in the film is you kind of call attention to the genre of it by having this Twilight Zone-like framing device. It's called Paradox Theater, and you found somebody who, for people who might remember, who sounds a little bit like Rod Serling. Tell me about that framing device and what it means in terms of what the audience is to assume about the story they're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, the framing device was, you know, written on page one, that you would see this old TV, and inside the old TV, you'd see an old TV show. And the way that the actors say their lines back and forth is, feels old. It feels like acting styles of the 50s and 40s. And then you push in, and then the black and white image on the TV melts away and it becomes color. And people hopefully start acting and talking a little bit more like what real life sounds like, both now and in 1958. And the game plan for that was to say, we understand that what you're about to see in terms of the plot is not necessarily breaking any ground. We know you've seen pictures like this. We know you've seen lights blinking on and off in people's homes and public spaces. And we know that weird noises, you know, have been used to come through the sound waves. And we know that you're familiar with this, but we think we have a new way to come at it. But we do want you to know that we're aware of our influences here. And we're aware of the history that led up to us taking a crack at this story. And so it's a little bit of a wink to say, we're with you, we know what we're doing here, and we still think we have something to add to the conversation.
We're talking with filmmaker Andrew Patterson about his film, The Vast of Night. I want to ask you about your screenplay that was written by you and James Montague and Craig Sanger. There are references to what the future might hold. The story unfolds in the 50s. Autonomous cars might exist, something like Elon Musk's vacuum tube travel might exist, but there's no way there's going to be cell phones. Tell us a little bit about what you were making fun of and what this time period allowed you to do in terms of looking at how people saw the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I remember being probably a 12-year-old, and my granddad, who was born in 1931, had told me about an experiment in 1956 or 57 done in Lincoln, Nebraska, where cars, full-size cars, were hooked up to radios, and they had a mile-long track, and they were all autonomous, and they moved together like a school of fish, and there was no, you wouldn't have to brake, and you wouldn't have to avoid anything. You could drive in the rain because it didn't matter, you know, if you could see or not. And he worked in the auto parts industry, and he got annoyed that that never came about. And, you know, this is, he's telling me this story in the late 90s, probably, or mid 90s. And he had theories about why it didn't occur. And I loved that notion that you could tell stories about the future from the past. And I love storytelling. I think you can sit in a theater and listen to people tell great stories. I think you can do it on radio. I think you can do it in books and graphic novels and radio podcasts in every format. And so in the beginning of the movie, we let our characters sort of dream. And I let the lead character played by Sierra, who plays Faye, get to tell these stories about the future will look like this. Telephones will look like this. Transportation will look like this. And they get to dream. And it's fun to get to play with people's perceptions of what would have been the future, you know, 60 plus years ago, and kind of get to see how things went one way when they thought they were going to go one way and maybe didn't go another way.
This is a period film, and its making is almost a period film. I think you wrote it in the summer of 2015. You filmed it in 2016. It premieres at the Slamdance Film Festival in early 2019, the Toronto Film Festival later that year, and now it's finally coming out. You played in a handful of drive-ins. You didn't get your theatrical release. How strange has this past 4 or 5 years been in bringing this movie out? Because even though movies take a long time, this one seems to have, you know, its own kind of shelf life.
Yeah, that's amazing how well you know our timeline, because I think people just, you know, in most productions, you get them done. You take a month or two or three to do, you know, your edit and so on. And your VFX might take longer if you have that. And then 6 to 8 months later at the most, usually less than a year, you're out. And we were so small that we ran through all of our money on the budget of on the production. And so most of our post-production just needed to be pushed along slowly as we got the budget to do a little bit more and so on. And then we had a whole year where we were not accepted by any film festivals at all. Like the entire calendar year of 2018 was 18 film festival rejections. And then at the end of that year, we got to one that we the festival that accepted us that played it was Slamdance, and their bylaws and everything that they stand for is that they will watch your movie all the way through. Nobody will just stop it after 5 or 10 minutes and make a call about it. They watch it with two different people, and they've netted some of the most incredible alumni. I mean, they played Bong Joon-ho's first feature. They played Chris Nolan's first feature. They played the Russo brothers' first feature. And just that alone, if that was the only three alumni you had, you would have this incredible festival. So they watched it and they liked it and they let us in. And then ever since, we've just sort of been on this year-long tour with the movie.
KPECC's John Horn interviewing first-time director Andrew Patterson. His debut, The Vast of Night, is streaming now on Amazon Prime. Great to have you with us, as always, on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll be back with you Monday morning at 10 on Air Talk.